Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
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 Point on chapter 11. Then we see is that life means Krishna. There's no Krishna, there's no life. It's a very simple point. One can say, well, life is going on even though Krishna's not there. But actually, life, anything that you consider life, anything worthwhile, anything you're attracted to, anything you need, any activity that's performed that gives a result, it's all Krishna. That's the fun part. But that's why it's called Maya, because we don't know that. Krishna's entered into everything, but in such a way that you can't see that he's the one doing it. It's a natural position. You see that because we're not in a good state. When one is in an unhealthy state, another partner takes the role of parental. Right? Parental meaning they are taking care of either the emotional or physical state of the other person. Right? So, therefore, that's why in any of the rasas you have these other mixes. Right? In the conjugal ras, also when the husband or wife take care of each other, when they're in that state, it's actually manifesting the parental ras. That's why it says that all five rasas are in the conjugal ras. So in parental, you know, you have friendship, you have servitorship. There's intimate friendship, then it also is mixed with parental. You know, intimate friend may take care of you and this and that when you're emotionally or physically have a problem. Does that make sense? All right. So in the parental relationship, then you have the element of most of what is done by the parent is unseen or unknown by the child. Right? Like, how many children actually understand what it takes to cook or clean? Now they come in, it's a nice house, it's nice this, everything's nice, but how much effort went into it? But it's not that the parent is trying to get them to see that. Right? Sometimes if there's an attitude, they may point it out. You know, you think you're working so hard, you're so intelligent, what about all this? You know? So, but otherwise, the thing is it's just the pleasure of performing those activities that are pleasing to that junior without them actually even understanding and knowing what's there. Right? So there's a lot of the satisfaction in that is in meditation, is in contemplation. It's not actually in the activity, right? It means you cook for 3 hours, but the actual eating time is 15 minutes. And then after that, there's the washing dishes, this, that, so many things. So all that is in contemplation of relationship. Does this make any sense? I mean, means what we're talking about, is this something that has been experienced, or at least you can relate to, or are we going way down the wrong path? Can you raise your hands if it makes sense? Huh. You did a little better than last time. Okay. Okay. Okay, so now the point we're making is it's the same thing. We think we're so big and cool and tough, but the point is we're still the kids. God's the Father. Right? So he's arranging all these things so we can go around and be, you know, whatever we think we are. Right? But the reality is that he's doing all these things. Right? You have dead matter. It means, okay, here would be like maybe a perceivable example. Let us take something that's in fashion, right? Or a fad, right? Do we all understand this? What a fashion is? Right? So now there's something that previously was not in fashion, the same item, now it is in fashion, right? And then after some time it's out of fashion again, right? Now when it's out of fashion, it is in no way attractive at all, right? But when it's in fashion, it's something that you gotta have, you'll kill for, Right? It's the same item. How did that happen? Right? Because the people want to put their consciousness in that way, therefore Krishna puts his potency into it to make it attractive. Because since when is dead matter attractive? Right? Prabhupada always gives the example, you have a living person, they're attractive. When they're dead, no one's attractive. Same body, same material energy. So when the soul's removed, then there's no attraction. So the soul's Brahman. Right? But the soul's limited in what he can enter, the soul can't enter into that column. But Krishna does. Right? That column is holding up this building, that's because Krishna is there in the potency of his Adhara Shakti to be able to hold it up. Does that make sense? So anything you find attractive, know it that it's not actually the item itself, it's Krishna. Right? So that's why we start with the whole universal form and all that. Because that's, then we get to know that Krishna is anything that we on the material platform think is important, it's actually Krishna. Right? And then one could say, okay, well this is Krishna, so therefore what's the problem that I'm enamored by it? Because since you know it's Krishna, then why would you be enamored by something small instead of direct? Right? It's just like, let us say, something is, some service or facility is being provided for you. You don't know where it's coming from. You appreciate it, you enjoy it, you know, you become attached to it. Then one day you find out that there's a person that's arranging that for you. It doesn't just happen. So now, would you go, oh great, and then just go on with enjoying the facility, or would you want to naturally contact that person and develop that direct relationship with them? Right? Does that make sense? So that's why the universal form, that realization is there for the beginning. It's to connect all your material attachments to Krishna. But as you actually realize that it is Krishna, it's natural that you will transfer that affection to the person who's arranging it. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah, so the point is that we're making is that therefore life is Krishna. Anything that's attractive to you, that's important to you, that you need, that you endeavor for, it's that Krishna's potency is in it. Doesn't matter what it is. It's your money, it's your house, it's your family, it's a position, it doesn't matter, it's because Krishna's there. Does that make sense? So that's the thing here we see is that chapter 11, Krishna's coming into Dwarka or leaving Hastinapur means life goes out of Hastinapur when Krishna leaves and life goes into Dwarka when he comes. But they're on the personal level that they're not worried about Krishna's universal form. Like we can see what Arjuna's reaction was to the universal form. Right? It wasn't like, you know, cool. You know, it was like he was not happy with it. Right? So he was more interested in the person because he had tasted it. We haven't tasted the person, therefore it has its interest. You know, oh wow, that's Krishna. Oh, I didn't talk about it like that. So that's nice. But eventually then we see is that Krishna is making all these arrangements. He's fulfilling all our material needs. So then why one wouldn't want to develop the relationship with the person who's actually taking care? Does that make sense? Right. Okay. Any questions on that? Chapter 12. The birth of Emperor Parikit. In Hastinapur, Parikit, destined to assume the throne Yudhishthira now occupies, is born. The palace astrologers see in this child the most worthy representative of the great dynasty into which he was born. Okay, so important here is the qualities of performing the duties. Duties are there. Duties, of course, in the Western paradigm is a very dirty, nasty, disgusting word. duties means, this is, we're taking Western perspective, we're not taking actual definition here. Duties means something that I do that I should do and it's good to do, but I really don't want to do it. That's the, you know, short Western definition of duty. Okay. Vedic definition of duty is, it is my opportunity according to my, or let's say it's the perfect situation according to my conditioned nature in which I can establish relationships and operate those relationships and get the benefit of those relationships from other people. Slightly different, right? Yeah, because the Vedic is personal, the Western is impersonal. Right? Because the Vedic is, I'm not God, I am a part of something bigger. And the Western is, I am God, and just somehow or another, I don't know why, no one else has realized it yet. But, you know, it should be obvious. But, does that make some sense? Okay. So, working on that, the Vedic paradigm here, that, okay, so a duty means your position in which you have you get benefits and you have obligations, because relationship means both. I get a benefit from a relationship, but I have an obligation, right? You understand? That's why the concept of economics is one of the four main principles, right, within human life, because you get nothing for free. Know that. It means the businessmen make a lot of money off of people who think they'll get things for free. You understand? They're very clever, because businessmen know everything you have to pay for. But they know that there's a class of people in the mode of ignorance that they expect they'll get it for free. Right? So you find ways that they don't feel that they're really paying anything. Does that make sense? I pay $1. I can win $1,000,000. But I still had to pay $1. No lottery ticket is given out for free. It costs you something. But you get 1,000,000 people together, you know, putting in a dollar, then there's $1,000,000. You understand? So if it's $1,000,000, then they expect that more than 1,000,000 will buy a ticket. So if they give away 1,000,000, great, but they put 1,000,000 in their pocket. They only had to pay for a few pieces of green paper, right? Does that make sense? So they're preying off of someone, I'm going to get this for free, right? Or your credit card. I can buy things for free, but it costs more to use it, because I buy it for this, but there's interest off of using it, right? Or you have a mortgage, or, you know, buy things on credit. You know, the thing would cost you $100,000, but you'll pay $150,000, right? Because it's buy now, pay later. So this concept of free. So the Vedic thing is, they understand everything costs. They're intelligent. They're realists. Somehow or another, the Westerners think they got the corner on the market of realism. But if you look at it, then realism starts here and goes out in concentric circles from here. And the farther it gets from here, the more unreal it is. Right? That's an interesting thing. Somehow or another, it really gets weird once you cross the Pacific and Atlantic Ocean. But up to that, it's all one kind of connected landmass. There's more of a concept of reality. Like that. So, but the reality then means, okay, I am the king. Great. And there'll be so much facility, but that facility is then to perform my duty, which is to protect the people. If I have to protect, I need money. So I get taxes, I get respect, because if there's no respect, who's going to care for my protection? If I say, yes, this will be done, but you don't respect, no one will feel comfortable. But if you respect the person, they say, don't worry, I'll take care of it, then you're peaceful. You understand? So respect and money, you know, opulence is important to protect. Does that make sense? Because if the respect is there, then that security is there. Right? And if the money is there, then gain is there. So gain and safety is what people look to towards the towards others. Right? There's a gain and there's some safety there. Does this make sense? Right? So
how do you say?
Yeah. So therefore then there is a reciprocal, he's getting all that facility, but then he has to protect the people. But people aren't protected, he's not actually performing his duty. That makes sense? So like that, there's this in every rasa, every aspect, every position in the Vedic culture. There's something that you're getting. Right? Does that make sense? You know, it's like, yeah. So everyone has somewhere where they gain, but somewhere where they have to pay. Right? Let's say you have some servants that are working for a wealthy family. Now after time, let us say we have a sophisticated wealthy family, refined wealthy family. They have furnitures, they have clothes, they have utensils. But because of their wealth or sophistication, then when it's a little bit not in good shape, then it's not useful to them. Does that make sense? So where does it go in the Vedic culture? Right? It doesn't go to a garage sale. It goes to the servants. That's where it's supposed to go. Your old clothes, I mean, you say old clothes for a sophisticated, it doesn't mean rags. It means, you know, one thread on the jari has been pulled out on the sari and it wrinkled down the thing and it doesn't, so it's not going to be used. Right? Does that make sense? So that means the servants in that wealthy family, they're wearing, you know, silk saris and this, and they've got fancy furniture and all, but it's a little used. But if you go into the common person's house, their stuff looks used and it's not of that caliber. So they're the servant of a wealthy, sophisticated person is living better than your average person, even though they're servants. Right? But they have to pay by being servants. Does that make sense? And you want that service from the servants, but you have to take care of them like their family. Right? So everybody has to pay. And everybody gets benefit. So the benefit is what is according to your nature, and the payment that you have to make is also according to your nature. So nothing's wrong. Non-Vedic means one militates against these things because one doesn't like that. But it actually is true to form. It is. Does that make sense? With that. Okay. So then the idea is that they're very happy because here's a person who is now going to take up the duties of the king just like Yudhishthira. So that means the kingdom will flourish very, very nicely, right? He'll be God-conscious, he has all good character and qualities needed. And so, therefore, then it is something, you know, very appreciated, because then the human life will go on very nicely. Okay? Any questions on this? Chapter 13, 14, and 15. Dhritarashtra quits home, the disappearance of Lord Krishna, and the Pandavas retire timely. Mahatma Vidura returns to Hastinapur after being exiled before the battle of Kurukshetra by the envious Duryodhana. He is greeted most warmly by the Pandavas, who lovingly respect him as a great devotee and saintly person. His main concern, however, is for his half-brother, the blind Dhritarashtra, who bears responsibility for the great trial of arms that cost him so dearly. Yet Dhritarashtra seems content to live like the household pet of the Pandavas, while it is Yudhishthira's open-heartedness that makes the old blind king feel welcome. Bhima is unforgiving. Vidura convinces Dhritarashtra to leave for the forest to practice mystic yoga. The ever-faithful Gandhari follows her husband. After a period of severe penance, Dhritarashtra leaves his body and Gandhari leaves hers in the forest of austerities. Though his offenses against devotees prevent his achievement of Krishna prema, Dhritarashtra is relieved of all his sins and attains impersonal salvation. Narada informs Yudhishthira of these events and hints that he and the Pandavas will have to leave the false security of a warm home to face the end of their earthly existences. Soon Yudhishthira and Bhima note many inauspicious signs. They suspect them to be indications that Lord Krishna has departed for his own abode. Arjuna returns from a visit to Dwarka in a state of tremendous emotional distress. He confirms that Sri Krishna and the entire Yadu dynasty have departed this world. Yudhishthira winds up his involvement with political matters and installs Pariksit as emperor of the world. The Pandavas walk to the northern lands ever covered by ice and snow, achieving perfection one after another until Yudhishthira, Dharmaraj himself, entered the abode of the Supreme Lord. Vidura left his body at Prabhash and resumed his position as Yamaraj. Draupadi and Subhadra returned to Lord Krishna, following the paths of their husbands. So then here is a part of the, how do you say? A part of the, how do you say? Literary theme that is not, is appreciated, but not necessarily always, because when you read other books, then it was mundane people, or it was a novel who was made up. But here, then the difficulty is the reality of the material world is temporary. And that whatever you have, it will be taken away. The eternality of the desire for relationship is there because of the nature of the soul. It's not a attainable reality in the material world. A relationship starts one appreciates those few moments of nice interaction, whatever it is. But with time, one wants those moments to be permanent. One doesn't want to have any situation wherein they may be lost. Right? So then at that point, temporary interactions that before were of great happiness no longer are satisfying. Because now one is looking at the relationship from the point of eternality. But the problem is because it's in the material world, it is temporary. And at one point that must be faced. So it's arranged that there is the pleasantness, the happiness that these things are a long way off. But it should have always kept in the back of the mind that spiritually one should be endeavoring as if this were the last moment. But economically, socially, you're endeavoring that it's going to go on forever. Does that make sense? These balances are very important. It's one thing that the Westerners are, how you say, exceedingly inept at. You know, they work on this very nice black and white, all or nothing principle, which sometimes works, okay, if you want to come from, you know, the slums, the ghettos, and then work and crawl your way up to the, say, claw your way up to the top would be the proper, you know, how you say, definition. And, you know, make yourself the, you know, maverick success, you know, outside the norm. Great. But somehow or another, in human life, there's a lot of shades of gray between 100% black and 100% white. Basically, you have 99 options of gray in between. Does that make sense? So, in here then, you have this balance of, I am endeavoring, I am making the full social endeavor, full social, economic, sensual endeavor, according this appropriate to my position and duties. But at the same time, as I'm keeping in the back of my mind, or in the forefront of my mind, that spiritual life is the most important, therefore I'm doing this to obtain that. If I perform it with knowledge, it's nice karma, it will give me liberation. If I perform it understanding it's actually Krishna, then I will start to wear away this point that I am God and that Krishna is actually the person. And it'll start to wear away that my interest in the material energy is what's important, but it's actually Krishna is actually the one that is of value in whatever I'm endeavoring for. Does that make sense? So one is able to happily go on with both at the same time. So this is reality. Reality is I make the full endeavor, but at the same time I'm fully making the spiritual endeavor. Because the soul, it's natural to be spiritual, but the conditioned nature, it's natural to make endeavor on that platform. Does that make sense? So the two do function. That's called the Vedic culture. Right? Vedic culture is probably one of the most misunderstood things there is. The Vedic culture is only for taking you back to Godhead. But the tendency is, we're giving you, this is Shastra. The feminine nature does generally not accept something on an intellectual platform. It only accepts after it's made the endeavor, run into the obstacles, and then can directly see, perceive that there is a problem. Right? This is female. Right? No ifs, no ands, no buts. The soul is female. We do exactly the same thing. So until we've endeavored and seen, okay, I want to get married, I want to have a family, I want to be successful, I want to be respected in society, I want. Okay, great. But now, you want to get that, okay, the Westerners, they don't really have an idea, it just happens. Okay, here is how you actually do it. This is the material world, it's made by God, and He says it works like this. You operate like this, you'll get it. Go for it. Now that you've gone for it, you have your money, you have your position, you have your family, you have everything like that. Okay, now that we have that, now I see I have all this, but I'm not satisfied. So now I could be an idiot and go, okay, well it's this wife, it's this family, it's this house, it's this car. If I got another wife, family, car, then I'd be happy. Okay, that's for idiots. But the real thing is, it's all the same, because it's Krishna's power in all of them. So it's not going to be any different. Right? You're in this car, that house, touch this girl, that girl, it's going to be the same experience. It's not different. It's only made that way because you have faith in material energy, so without the concept of variety, you get bored and then we really have a tough time, because everyone would be an absolute in manic, depressive ignorance, so nothing would happen in the material world. So you have to give hope to the people by the mode of passion. That variety, right? That's the mode of passion, is that you see everything is different. Right? Mode of goodness is you understand it's one soul. The concept of soul and anything is the same. Dog is the same. Doesn't matter if it's, you know, some Chihuahua, you know, in Mexico, or some Pekingese over in, you know, wherever pecan is, you know, like that. Does that make sense? Right? Dogness is the same. So everything is the same. Foodness, you know, conjugalness, parentalness, friendshipness. It doesn't matter where it is, what level it is, it's all the same. You can see the mother sitting on the side of the road, sitting in the gutter with her kid, and stroking their head and this and that and picking out the lice, and it's the same affection as the sophisticated, wealthy mother, you know, playing with the hair, it's not quite right, one strand's in the wrong place before you go to school. The experience is exactly the same. But because we're fools, motive passion makes us think it's different. But it's the same. So this is only brought home to those who actually want to go home. If you want to stay here, it's not brought out, because then you fall into ignorance, nothing works. Material world works because of passion. And from passion, it's easier to get to goodness than it is from ignorance. Does that make sense? So then, this principle is that the material energy, the living entity has to try experience it. Right? The best is that they've done it by hearing. Then next is by seeing. Next is by experiencing. Right? First class, second class, third class intelligence. Generally, it's understood that if someone can learn by hearing means they've already previously done the others, but they haven't finished. You know, their realization is to that level. Now they've come in contact with it again, it's revived. So then immediately you have this new bhakta who's functioning on some levels of realization that you wouldn't expect, because they've already done so many things before. You know, it's said someone is a good brahmachari because they've already done the whole grihastha thing previously. And so now they're still working out. There's something else they're attached to, you know, that rasguler or that gulab jamun or whatever it was, you know. Like that, you know. Chugging the gulab jamun juice after the Sunday feast or, you know, whatever is their particular reason they're still here, right? You know, so does that make sense? It's been done. So the living entity has this tendency that unless they've done it, then they don't feel confident to leave it. Does that make sense? And the idea is leave it means leave it. It's not that you leave it and then go off and then, you know, start it all up again. Does that make sense? Right? So the Vedic culture is therefore how to properly operate the material energy in relationship to Krishna consciousness. Right? But because of the impersonal proclivity in the, you know, most living entities, but especially the Western culture, then the tendency is spiritual means different from material. So if I'm spiritual, I do nothing with material. Which is fine if you can do it. That's better, right? Krishna says, first option, just surrender. Why bother with any process, right? You surrender. Don't bother with all this, all these different practices. Just surrender and become pure devotee this second. I mean, it happens. Gopis did it. Maharaj Katbanga did it. Plenty of people did it. So it is possible. If you can't follow, then follow the sadhana. You know, then don't take much part or interest in material life. Don't worry about it. Just get into your sadhana and perfect yourself. If you can't do that, then you work for him. Means follow the varnashram in naishkarmya. Right? And if you can't do that, then follow in sakam. Right? If you can't do that, be a nice guy. Right? Open hospitals, give in charity, you know, do all these things. If you can't do that, last ditch, okay, be a hardcore first class impersonalist. Because at least they're not materially entangled. Does that make sense? Right? So, then, the idea then is whatever the situation you need to be on whatever thing, it's not necessarily all things have to be on the same level. So you might be more detached on one aspect, more attached on another aspect. You know, maybe you don't need a big house, but you need millions of clothes. You don't need clothes, you need a house. You don't, or you don't need that, you need good food. Or you don't need that, you just need some respect. Whatever it is. So one area may be more advanced in your realization than another. But the idea is you should be working on it. Right? So then the Vedic culture gives you the opportunity in which you can be more or less absorbed in anything, and it's compatible with spiritual life and with everybody else's material and spiritual endeavor. Right? So it's a perfect blend. So that's the purpose of duty, is when I'm in ignorance, I have to do it because otherwise I won't do anything. Mode of passion is, I want what I want, but because of duty, I also have to give what I'm expected to reciprocate for what getting what I want. Mode of goodness is, I do it because it makes everything function properly in the society, plus I have to have some medium through which to practice my God consciousness. Right? It's practiced through activity, not through inactivity. Right? So since I have the conditioned nature to do this, why not do this? It's no problem. Right? So in the beginning, boys interested in the girls, this, that. Okay, hey, let's get it together. You have to get married. Okay. So then instead of just playing around and being, you know, how you say, just exploitive, now he's married. So now, motive passion, okay, now I'm getting what I want. No, but you also have to reciprocate. Okay, so now he has his parts that he has to put in, get back what he gets out of it. by doing this in Krishna consciousness, then he realizes that, hey, you compare what I get out of the family life and what I get out of Krishna consciousness, it doesn't compare. Right? Because I put a lot of value in material, therefore when I first get it, those first years, it does seem very prominent, and it sometimes even distracts me from my spiritual life. So spiritual life kind of gets a little sidelined, though it's there. Because, you know, the newness of the relationship and everything, and working hard and establishing yourself and making plans, and right? But with time, I got this stuff, I've done this stuff. The things are going on. Now the relationship is open, and whatever, however interaction you want to interact, it happens. That trust is there. That maturity is there. But you compare that to a nice kirtan or just nice devotional interaction, it doesn't add up. Right? Plus we start to see that, well, that taste that I'm getting from the kid, being with the kid or with the wife, or that is actually Krishna. It's not them, it's Krishna. Through his potency, he's come to me as this. I want to have rasa. Rasa means with God, but since I'm trying to cut God out of it, then God comes in this hidden form as my kid, or as my money, or as my position. And so then I am reciprocating with God. He sees that, we don't. Right? So then slowly, slowly, then we start to see these things. Now, this is the point. When, if you follow the Western Padati, then, oh, this is all Maya, this is all nonsense. And then you drop it all. And then you go on in your drive, you know, spiritual drive, and about 10 years later, then you find another lady and start another family and the whole thing all over again. Okay, so, but the Vedic is that shouldn't happen. So, therefore, when you figure it out, now it's like, now you finally understand what's actually going on. You know, all this time you're in illusion. You heard about it. You'd even talk about it. You even talk about it in the class. You tell other people. In fact, you use it to your advantage as a manager. You know? But in your own life, hey, that's another thing. So, but now, it's duty. Right? Means, in other words, I'm still not fully Krishna conscious. I'm still not completely detached. Here's another point. Would be the difference between jnana and vijnana. Jnana means I have the understanding of it. Vijnana means I realize it and I can actually function on that platform. That is my preferred platform of functioning. Does that make you understand? So what happens in the Western paradigm, as soon as there's understanding, then the ignorance is bliss as part is gone. You look for where some fresh ignorance. Right? Like that. So then it's left. But the Vedic is, that's where it actually starts. The day you actually understand how everything about what you're doing in your grihastha life is illusion, that's the day you actually become a grihastha. A real, bona fide, dynamic, Krishna-conscious grihastha. Before that, it was you were a grihastha with different shades of griha-madiness. But because your determination was grihastha, therefore you're called a grihastha. Just like we're called devotees because our determination is to become one, though we're not. Devotee means prema-bhakti. Below prema-bhakti, we are not devotees. But because the purpose is to develop that prema bhakti, therefore you're called a devotee. Does that make sense? Right? You go to school, right? You learn your ABCs. You're called a student. But are you interested? No. Factually, postgraduates, they're called students. Right? Because they actually want to know what's going on in this. Does that make sense? Before that, it's something you have to do, or it'll get you a job. No, but after that, it's because you don't have to. Postgraduate, no one has to do. It's because you actually want to know. And at that point, you understand that no matter how much you know, the ocean of the knowledge becomes bigger, and that you know nothing. Right? So a real student understands I know nothing. Well, the other students think I know so much. So they're not actually students. You understand the point we're making here? So you become the real brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, when you understand the material uselessness of the thing itself. But you have the maturity to understand that this is my conditioned nature. And this is understanding, not realization. So I have to stick with this until it becomes realization. Right? In other words, by dealing with this, I've, as a medium, grihastha life, for example, I have come to understanding its position. Now, if I continue performing the same duties, I will come to realization of the position. Then it can be left. But at the same time, as if you actually understand, it doesn't matter if it's left or not. You understand? Leaving it is a thing to distance yourself, to create that, but if you're already realized, it doesn't matter if you leave or not. Right? So, here's where duty comes in. Now it's the other side. You're doing it not because you need it. Right? Beginning from ignorance is you're doing the duty, it's forced upon you because you don't want it. Right? But here is, you don't need it. Right? You don't need the benefits of it. But, because it's your conditioned nature, therefore it's a comfortable position to be in. Right? Everything's there, he's got his place, he doesn't have to worry about, he's got his income, he's got relationships, and everything's worked out so that nicely you can just, in a regulated way, engage in Krishna consciousness. So therefore, then one continues. It's a very nice, comfortable place. Does that make sense? Just like if you're going to chant your japa, you know, one would say, oh, but then that's, you know, we bring up the impersonal, you know, how you say, demon raises its head, but then, you know, why not? You know, because it's kind of like Krishna consciousness has got to be tough. You know, it's like Chinese medicine. It's got to be taste bad or hurt or something. If it doesn't, it's not good. You know, if it tasted nice, it's kind of like, you call this medicine? Does that make some sense? There's that kind of thing of if it's rough and hurt, then you feel, yes, something's going on, you know. Like, you could go out for a walk, you know, in a pleasant place, but, you know, you go out in cold wind, you know, yes, fresh air, feel the crispness and all that, you know, your nose is falling off, your toes are falling off, but you feel good, you know, like that. So, I think that the tendency is like, you know, if it's pleasant and it's nice, then it must be Maya. You know, but Krishna is nice. Bhakti is nice. So, would you, you know, go chant your japa out there on the road where they're there with the jackhammers and the cranes and all the guys yelling and screaming and cursing and all that? Or would you rather be in a peaceful place where there is no noise and you can just chant? Does that make sense? So that's what we mean by the grihastha life at this point is comfortable. You see the connection? Right? It's a place where you can very nicely perform your Krishna consciousness without any obstacles, without any interruptions, other than what material energy, you know, provides with birth, death, old age, disease. But other than that, then, does that make sense? So, that is the Vedic meaning of duty. Right? So it's very, very, very different than the Western presents it, generally. You get glimmers of it if you have not crossed the Atlantic or Pacific. But, in any case, does this make sense? So, this is this approach to the Vedic culture and Krishna consciousness, where the culture and the religion, I mean the culture and the philosophy are combined. Prabhupada says, religion without philosophy is sentiment. Hindu. And philosophy without religion is mental speculation. Western culture. Right? Does that make sense? So, the whole idea is that it's a complete path. You can't function without both. You have to have a culture and you have to know where you're going. Does that make some sense? So that's what all this is being done. That's why Purana is used. Otherwise, if it was just a matter of understanding philosophy, why do we need Purana? So much time is taken up in the story. There's only 555 sutras in the Vedanta Sutra. That's all. Right? Nothing. So if you just want to get down to hardcore philosophy, why aren't we studying that? Right? No, because you have to have the culture along with the philosophy. Right? Vedanta Sutra exclusively is for sannyasis, because they don't bother much with the culture. Right? But even then, when they come across Krishna consciousness and the proper culture, they take it up. Right? Prakashananda Saraswati, he was no small time Mayavadi. You know, Sukadev Goswami, you know, was no small time impersonalist. Right? Like that. Does this make some sense? So therefore, this ability, so how this all came about is we're trying to show that Vedic culture means you're taking two seemingly contradictory platforms and perfectly combining them to make a perfectly working situation. Right? That's the normal, simplified, non-Vedic think. It's this or it's that. No, it's both together. Right? Does that make sense? The parent is the authority of the child. Yes? No? Okay. But what does the parent spend all their time doing for the child? Serving. That's a serious contradiction. Right? So, it works. Right? So that's more complex, and then you get contradictory. It's even more complex than that. More contradictory. Does that make sense? So, ability to balance two contradictory things, the maturity to do that, that's offered by the Vedic culture. It's not offered by the modern. Modern, you have people who observe it, figure out parts of it, write books on it, give seminars and lectures on it, but because it's only a part, it works in some areas and then it doesn't work somewhere else. And then people are frustrated again. But the Vedic is the complete package. It's already considered everything. The Brahmin can do this because it's already considered what a Kshatriya Vaishya Shudra does. Right? It's not exclusive. That makes sense? Okay. So here is to be the ability, now back to the original point, the ability to function in society with determination and enthusiasm, at the same time being able to balance that this is all temporary, is going to be lost, so I better get it together in Krishna consciousness. Right? Does that make sense? So here we see is, here's the conclusion, here's the closing. Right? The closing of the pastimes. So it's because that's the way it is. The pastimes are eternal, but because the nature of the material world is temporariness, therefore there's the need for the temporary manifestation of it. Otherwise people here, you know, though they want good endings, don't really like good endings. You know? I think it's a bit corny. Because they've never in their unlimited existences here ever found that it ever was. You know, they always died. You know what I'm saying? So living happily ever after is for the kids, you know. Does that make sense? So here, then we're bringing in the point of the dukkalaya ashashvatam. The material world is temporary and full of miseries. But Krishna consciousness isn't like that. So he's seeing all these different things are all being added in these as the chapters go. These things, but we see before was all the plus and the positive and all these different things. Only after you understand what is positive, then you can understand what is negative. Right? Krishna doesn't put you into separation without putting you into union first. Right? Narad Muni first, you know, saw or heard the Lord, then he didn't. Right? The gopis are with Krishna, then he goes away. Right? Positive always has to be understood before you can discuss negative. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah? No? You want to understand what is reinitiation. You'll never understand it if you don't know what is initiation. Right? So if you want to discuss and study reinitiation, it's not a separate topic. You first figure out and exactly clearly state what is initiation, what it is. Then you can understand what the other is. Right? Until you understand what is creation, you can't understand what's recreation. Right? Does that make sense? So the positive is always the first thing that one studies. Then from there, then one studies the variations or the negative elements of it. Right? This is the process. Right? So the modern concept of, well, you have to give them a broad range of things, you know? No. You first give them what is the reality, and exactly that, and when they're practiced in that, then you start to show what are variations on it. That's the actual method of teaching. You mix it all up, then you get all these nice mixed up kids, because they don't know the difference between what is the main and what is secondary, because it's all mixed together to create variety. Does that make sense? So therefore we see it's very nicely going. Any questions on this?
Chapter 16, How Pariket Received the Age of Kali. Touring his kingdom to establish his authority over the earth, the young emperor Pariket sees a Shudra beating a cow and bull. The king realizes the bull is Dharma, the cow is Bhumi, and the Shudra, who is dressed like a king, is none other than the personality of Kali. So Kali is part of the creation, because material world means it goes from goodness to ignorance, right? Spiritual means it goes from ignorance to goodness, right? And then to transcendental. Does that make sense? So you must have Kali Yuga. He is one of the officers of the universe, but at the same time, Pariket's duty is to protect the cow and the bull. So then he must see that they're protected. You know, we could say, well, Kali has to do his thing. No. He can go do his thing elsewhere, you know. For those who want it, then he can go to places where such people exist. So where the regulative principles are not being followed, where gold is being hoarded, he can go reside there, because those people already have a problem. Right? Does that make sense? So he's able to, therefore, protect both. Why are you leaving it 5-2? No, but we leave it the 9 this time. We started 8 our time, so it's 5 minutes early. But we ended 9 this time. Okay. So we were doing before. So then, okay. So it means he just has to do all this properly. Okay. Any questions on this? Anything? No.
Chapter 17, Punishment and Reward of Kali. Kali surrenders to Maharaj Pariket, who spares the Yuga Purusha's life. He orders Kali to leave his kingdom, but Kali pleads that since the king rules the entire earth, he will find no place to stay anywhere. Pariket grants Kali residence in any place where meat-eating, illicit sex, gambling, and intoxication are practiced. Kali manages to get one more concession from the king, that he may also stay wherever gold is hoarded. Because of Pariket's unrivaled authority over the earth, Kali finds himself under severe limitations, still, despite his negotiation with the king. He decides that Maharaj Pariket must be removed from his position by trickery. Yeah. Chapter 18. Maharaj Pariket cursed by a Brahmin boy. By the influence of the Lord in his form of time, Pariket commits a minor offense against sage Samika. The sage was in deep meditation within his cottage, and was thus unaware that the king had come to his door due to the pushings of hunger and thirst. Kali enters the Brahmin sage's son, Sringi. He is induced to curse the king to die within 7 days. When the sage comes out of his trance and realizes what has happened, he instructs Sringi that he has made a big mistake. There can be no better kshatriya than King Pariket to represent the Supreme Lord to the general people. If he dies, by the bite of the snake bird that Sringi pronounced in his curse must kill the king, then Kali will take full control of the earth. The Brahmin class will be held responsible by history for the degradation of the whole planet.
Yeah, so he must find a place. Everybody must find. So that is the point in Krishna consciousness, is finding some place for everybody. Means you have the position of those who want to dedicate themselves full time, not worry about anything really material, just whatever comes along easily. Then you have the temple life. Those who need more than that, want to take more, you know, more facility, then they must take responsibility for these things, and you have various degrees of the community. Does it make sense? So there's a place for everybody. This is always an important point. Here one sees is that Kali surrenders. Therefore, a surrendered person must be given a place. So it's not that those who are in the community are in Maya, or those in the temple are in Maya. It's that everything must be considered. This is leadership. Is that those who are interested in the proper progress of human life must be given a place. Right? That's important. That's how leadership works. Right? Bureaucracy, of course, cannot understand this because it's rules and papers. No one's ever expected a bureaucrat to ever do that. But leadership means that this is what's done. Right? So we see here, Parikit is a leader. That's why the Brahmins before were very enthusiastic when they saw his chart, when he was born. Because they knew here is a leader. Here is someone who will do something right. He will find a place for everyone. Even Kali finds a place. Right? Not much of a place, but a place nonetheless. Right. So then for Kali Yuga to happen, then that means we must remove the king. So then through this activity with the son of Samika Rishi, then he is able to remove this. So the Brahmins are the ones that establish the society. They're the ones that maintain the society. Therefore, that's why how do you say, Samika Rishi was worried that the Brahmins will be blamed because they're the ones that keep things in order. They know what's going on. The kings will effect it, and by the training they've received from the Brahmins, they will, you know, independently perform their duties. But, or not independently, let's say, autonomously they'll perform. But they know that the actual direction is from the Brahminical standard, the Brahminical culture. That's where it's all held together. So if you degrade the Brahminical culture, then you can erode the society. So if one wants to establish Varnashram, one has to first establish Brahmins. Then those Brahmins can create Kshatriyas, and the Kshatriyas will create the rest of it. Does that make sense? Vaishyas are already making money, Shudras are already eking out their existence. So the Kshatriya will create a protected environment in which then the whole society can function. Does that make sense? He'll make it scientific. Any questions on this? No? Okay, so then we'll continue. Then tomorrow we'll go to the 19th chapter. It means that'll be the full study. 19th chapter, so if anyone hasn't read the chapter in that, then that can be done too. So continue. Gantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jainitai Gaur Premanandi.